You're listening to Convenience Matters, brought to you by NACS. Whether it's for food, fuel, drinks, or snacks, about half the U.S. population shops at a convenience store every day. We'll talk about what we see at stores and what the future may hold for our industry.
Welcome to Convenience Matters. My name is Jeff Leonard with NACS.
And I am John Eichberger with NACS and the Fuels Institute.
So, John, the convenience industry has been around for about 90 years. And a family, the Strasburgers, has been part of the industry in terms of fuels and in terms of convenience stores for about 65 of those years. So there's a rich history to learn about how did the convenience store industry evolve. And where are they going? Where is it going next? And that's the conversation we're going to have today. But first, Carolyn, want to share a little bit of member news for June?
Well, I wanted to say thank you and recognize Parkers for donating $22,000 to Savannah Chatham County Public Schools. Parkers, headquartered down in Savannah, Georgia, really gives back to their community through their Fueling the Community charitable initiative. And I think it's great to recognize your teachers, your students, and let your customers give back to their own communities.
And Carolyn, we know that convenience stores give about $1 billion a year to charity. It's another way to stand out and to build that loyalty. We hope to share many more ideas like this. So today we're joined by Roy Strasburger. Roy is the president of Strasburger. And welcome, Roy.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We started out by talking about your family's been in the business for 65 years. You've been in the business for almost 50 years. How did it start for you?
Well, it started for me probably when I was just getting into elementary school, and my father wanted me to help out in one of our local convenience stores during the summer. So my job was to go out to the cars as they drove up, take their order, go pick the order up and carry it outside to deliver it to the car so people didn't actually have to come into the store. And that also included tasks such as the inevitable cleaning of the floors, stocking of the shelves, dusting of the shelves all the time. And something that's probably a little bit peculiar to Texas is that back in those days you had glass soda water bottles, Coke bottles, and those bottles were brought back to be returned to the bottler. And because of the way the system was set up, the bottles had to be sorted by bottler to be sent back. And so the bottles would be returned. They'd still be partially filled with Coke or Dr. Pepper, and especially in Texas. And since this was in the summer, all of these bottles were kept out back. And so in the 100-degree heat, the bottles, I would get to sort the bottles, fight off the bees and the flies that were coming after the syrup, and try to provide some semblance of an organized return policy to the bottlers.
And those, that's were, why Texas, I decided those were Texas-sized flies, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's why I decided I wanted to spend more time inside the store as opposed to outside of the store. What it did for me was gave me a very good understanding of the basics of how to make a store run, what you need to do to operate it, the customer service aspects of it. And I continued working through elementary school and middle school in the stores in the summertime, eventually learning how to run the register and doing those type of skills. And then in high school and even in college, I was doing pump repair maintenance for our fuel facilities and doing repair work inside the stores as well as running some shifts occasionally. So I've been, for most of my life, my only real job has been in the convenience store industry.
So, I mean, I'm having a hard time getting an image out of my head. Little Roy Strasburger on roller skates taking products out to cars. But it's, I mean, you're describing, you know, a family run convenience store, and over the time you guys have been in business, I mean, things have changed dramatically. You guys have been involved globally. I mean, you guys have done tremendous things. I mean, how, from your perspective, if you could step out and look at it, what have been the most dramatic changes you've seen in the industry during your time, from the time you were delivering groceries and convenience store goods out to the customers to now when you guys are helping people develop their strategies to run their companies?
Well, most, as you would probably guess, most of the major development or changes is technology oriented. Things like credit card acceptance, which when I first started in the business, it was all cash. Pay at the pump technology. In Texas, air conditioning was real exciting at one point. And just the way that we're able to interact and provide a faster, more efficient program to our consumers based upon a lot of the technology side of it. What, from a customer service point of view, I think a lot of the basics are still the same, that that you're trying to provide the best operation you can, the cleanest operation you can, great customer service and being friendly and providing the products and the items that people want at a reasonable price. And speaking of products, I guess the other big development that I've seen is been more in the movement towards fresh products, better for you products, chilled, ready to go meals. That was something that, you know, we really couldn't really conceive of back even 20 years ago. And a lot of that was introduced by way of Europe, the development in the convenience store and the supermarket businesses in continental Europe had a lot of impact on the way our business developed here in the United States, certainly in the late 90s and the early 2000s.
And I'm glad you mentioned overseas, because the convenience store industry was born in Dallas in 1927, and it stayed largely a U.S. business for a number of years. And then somebody had the idea, hey, maybe other countries' convenience also works. And your company or your family's business has been integral over the years in looking at opportunities in other countries. What were the early things that they noticed in terms of what might work in other countries, or what might you take from other countries here besides the idea of food from Europe?
Well, if I can be bold enough to say that some of the things that we exported to other places was the concept of customer convenience. I mean, one of the things that I think we were really trying to drive was the fact that as a convenience store operator, we sell time to people. And in most other markets, convenience was sort of based on location, that if you're conveniently located in the neighborhood, you're easy to get to by walking or public transportation. But the hours that the sites were open, the range of products that the store had didn't always maximize the convenience aspect, or at least the way we saw it in the United States. So our first market that we went into was in Australia back in the early 80s. And we opened one of the first 24-hour convenience stores in Sydney that had all of the traditional convenience type items that we would see in the United States located inside the store, easy ingress and exit to be able for the customer to come in and buy something quickly. As a happenstance, we were one of the first companies in Australia to offer self-service fuel that allowed people to fuel up quickly and for us to reduce our price of gasoline, because we were doing it self-service rather than full service. So really where our focus on differentiating ourselves in the other markets was providing more convenience and more time saving to people. And I think that was had a huge impact. And other folks, especially the international and multinational oil companies, followed along those lines and started developing the same type of products. As far as things that we brought back with us, a lot of that was geared towards, as I mentioned earlier, the fresh food or the fresher food items, and trying to deliver or develop a supply chain that we could have refrigerated and fresh products in the store that would not go bad, or that we could certainly have a velocity enough to turn through them without a lot of spoilage. And that's still a challenge for us in a lot of places in the United States, of being able to get fresher products in the store and have them move fast enough so that they can stay fresh and appetizing. But Europe, and specifically Ireland and the UK, were real developers in chilled foods and taking what we consider to be almost the fresh grab-and-grow side of the business to convenience level and really having it out there. And then the Japanese developed the just-in-time delivery system that they worked with. But the Japanese advantage was that they had their own commissaries and a very high-density footprint of stores that made deliveries very easy. Whereas in Europe, the convenience store companies and the small retailers initially were working with the supermarket chains to get fresh products into their stores. So the two sides of the business kind of evolved in different ways.
So I've listened to you talk about the first store in Australia. It makes me think, you know, Jeff, here in the U.S., we always say that the localized flavors vary tremendously. A convenience store in southern Louisiana cannot export that exact model and do well in Seattle, Washington. I have to think that if you went into Sydney to open up the first 24-hour convenience store, the amount of either you went in with a model that was that this worked in the U.S., it's going to work here, and then you learned, or you did some major research to find out what types of local flavors you need to adapt to. And as you start looking at other countries, what did you learn in terms of being able to evaluate the local market and really capitalize on what those your customers in those areas are going to want?
Well, because of our local upbringing here in Texas, I will admit that when we first opened our first few stores in Australia, it was very much a replica of the stores that we were running in Texas. And we knew that we were going to have to do a lot of learning as to what's necessary for the local appetite, for the local cultural situation. But we needed a place to start. So, for example, what we learned was that while fountain drinks, let's take that as an example, fountain drinks in Texas specifically, in the United States generally, are very popular. And the fact that people like to put ice in their drinks to keep it cold, in Australia, fountain drinks really never caught on because people kept thinking that putting ice in their drinks was cheating themselves of the amount of soft drink they were getting. And so the profitability equation was quite a bit different in Australia because, you know, obviously the more ice you have, the greater your profit margin on a soft drink. And the Australians were very quick to cotton on to that, and they figured that bit out. Another example would be things like hot food, fresh food that you would pick up. We had to radically redo what our condiments were for a hot dog, for example, based upon what the local tastes were. It was much more than ketchup and mustard and relish and maybe cheese.
Yeah, Vegemite. I mean, it would be Vegemite, sorry? Right?
Yeah, Vegemite, for example. Or, you know, and when we were selling hot dogs in Norway, it's all about the mayonnaise shrimp that you put on top of it. And,
wait,
like that.
Did you just say mayonnaise shrimp?
Yes. Okay. We were at one point running some stores in Norway, and we were the largest per store seller of hot dogs in all of Norway. We were really proud of that at one point. So, for us there was a lot of fine tuning, and as we developed our international program, we eventually were either operating or overseeing stores in 33 countries, and we developed a fairly robust market development program that when we went into a market, we would scout out what the local purveyors were doing. So everything from the local corner grocery stores to the local restaurants to the street food, and find out what they were doing and then incorporate those things into our first store models as we go in, and then fine-tune those as we go into it. So once again, for example, in the Philippines, we opened a convenience store, and one of the delicacies in the Philippines, and I forgot the name of it, but basically what it is it's a semi-hard-boiled egg, but it actually has a chicken in it as opposed to just a yolk. And so when you bite into the hard-boiled egg, it's very crunchy. And this is apparently something that people really like to have, which would never have occurred to me to put into a convenience store.
This is the chicken or egg dilemma.
Yeah, well, you can have both now. So I mean, it's really trying to get into what you're developing. I mean, fresh food in Europe is that you have it in a nice plastic package, refrigerated and well lit. Fresh food in Asia means that it's still alive and moving. And so you really got to understand what the terminology, what the sensitivities are, and how you want to cater to those needs. Because ultimately, that's what you've got to do, because that's how you drive yourself.
Well, what's interesting, what you just were talking about, is doing operations in dozens of countries. You need to be very centralized, but you're also saying that you need to be very localized in understanding local trends, local preferences. Is there any guidance or suggestion that you would have to an operator that may just have 30 stores in a market? How do they become local? How do they tap into a trend in that may be at one store but not another store, and it might be in the same county? So how do you do what you did on a global level and do it in a market?
Well, the way that we approach it is that we consider it goes in a few different levels. The first is that the infrastructure, the way the store is set up and operated, and the policies and the procedures, the paperwork and all that, absolutely needs to be standardized wherever you go. And the reason for that, which I think is fairly obvious, is that that's the way that you control the store. As long as everybody knows what is expected and how the reporting or the procedures or the operational expertise is supposed to be developed and implemented, then everybody can be on the same page, and then you can build around that. So that's kind of the skeleton work. Then we consider that probably around 50 to 60% of any store has the same core items. So in every store, we're going to be selling Coca-Cola. We're going to be selling a Snickers bar. I mean, there's the SKUs of 60% are about the same wherever we go. But that other 40%, we try to fine-tune to the local neighborhoods. And the way that we try to do that is we go out and do, first of all, competitive shops. Well, actually, first of all, what we do is we look at the demographic information. So what is the ethnic, the cultural, the economic makeup of our market area that where we're locating the store? So that gives us an idea of types of products, pricing of products, how we're trying to provide the best service to that group of customers. That gives us our starting base. And we look at what the local competition is selling. And one of the things that we try to focus on is local competition based upon close access of transportation. And what I mean by that, we look at competitors who have a lot of walk up, bicycle up, or public service bus traveling, because those are your locals. The people, if your competitor is, for example, a really good Chinese grocery down the store, but everybody's driving in from all across town to buy from that grocery store, that may not be what your local neighborhood flavor is as far as the people who live there. So we try to make sure that our retailers that we're competitively surveying are serving the local market and not just somebody who's in a unique niche for some reason. We flagrantly copy what we think their best sellers are. We look at their competitive pricing. We go back, and if we don't have that supplier, that product through our current supplier, we'll find suppliers who'll provide it. And then we start off by promoting it so that people in the neighborhood know that we're selling things that might be of interest to them. So we try to fine tune it on what we call a corner to corner basis of developing a marketing program and a product selection.
So taking that history and your ability to analyze and learn from foreign markets and domestic markets, a lot of people are looking south of the border. You're there in Texas, so Mexico is right across the border with deregulation, the introduction of competition down there. As retailers think about potentially going into the Mexican market, if you were to be looking at it yourself, what types of things would you be looking for to give you the indication of go, no go, tweak it this way, tweak it that way? What are the kind of major trends that would really kind of signal you, now's the time to do it, and this is the way we should probably go about it?
Are you talking along the lines of like if we were to open a store, if we were to work with somebody in opening stores?
Right.
Okay. Well, we've done some consulting work in the past, and we've done work with Pemex and with Pemex dealers before deregulation. In talking to some of the folks who are getting into the market now and kind of comparing notes, I think what our thoughts were are at that time are still relevant to what's going on. But it goes back down to, first of all, what is your local market? And one of the things that we discovered in the past is that you have to be very careful how you pitch the vision or the appearance of the store. If, to take very broad generalizations, if you go into a lower economic neighborhood and you're trying to provide a retail service to them, you don't want to necessarily introduce a store that you would put into a high-income neighborhood, because the people who are coming into that store will not necessarily feel that they are appropriate to be shopping there. So you have to be aware of all sorts of cultural sensitivities, economic sensitivities in developing that. We helped a person develop a store south of Mexico City about 15 years ago, and he wanted a very high-end store. He selected the site and wanted a very high-end store, and we helped him put that together. And when we were doing customer surveys after it opened, 15% of the people who came in told us they felt like they had to go home and clean up before they could come to the convenience store, because it was such a nice store, they didn't want to come in their work clothes. And so you have to be really careful in how you, as I said, how you kind of pitch where you're going for that. But what we also discovered is that the definition, and this is true in most markets, the definition of necessities and convenience items and the definition of what a luxury item is varies greatly by culture, by economics, and by neighborhood. So where in the United States a craft beer could be seen as a luxury type item, you know, just a regular mass market produced beer in Mexico is a luxury item for a lot of people. So you got to be able to know what you're offering and how you're providing it and what you're trying to promote. And the lifestyle. Make sure that your promotions are meeting the lifestyle of the local area.
Well, what I'm struck by, Roy, is we started out and you had talked about delivery and bringing products to the customer. And that is, we call that today, frictionless. Mm-hmm. And the idea of what you started out with 40, 50 years ago is really may have disappeared for a little bit, but is now a thing again. Are there any trends that you feel are timeless that we need to pay more attention to as we look to the next decade and beyond related to convenience?
I think that the two basics that is going to the two basics that are going to maintain the convenience store industry kind of as we know it is one is customer service. Because regardless of what you can click or have delivered or whatever you do with it, at the moment, people on the move need to have immediate needs satisfied or some type of need taken care of. And the best way of doing that is in person at the time on demand. And so the customer service aspect of that, which goes to being frictionless, is the most important thing. And by frictionless, that to me, that goes back to what we've always said, is that we're trying to sell time. And that if we can make it easy for people to do it, either through payment methods, how they actually receive their items, and how long it takes them to get in and out of the store or on and off the property, that whole customer service aspect of it is what the focus needs to be on. The second needs to be on presentation. And presentation is not just how the products are on the shelf, but how the business is presented to the street, to the customer. Because more and more, the way a store presents itself, the way that the visual appeal is to the customer, the way that a customer perceives how they fit, how that store fits into their lifestyle, is becoming more important than branding itself. I mean, I think that, you know, certainly with the oil company brands, I think that's become less important as far as fuel branding goes. I think to a degree, convenience store branding is not as important as convenience store presentation. So if, you know, you had a really good Jeff's shop on the corner and it was well done, well presented, and frictionless customer service, I think you've got a fairly secure place to be for the next 30 years, because that aspect is going to be there for a long time. So I think if we keep our eyes on those two basic aspects, the people who don't follow those two guidelines are the ones who are going to fall out, either to competitors who pay attention to it or to other types of delivery systems that can get their products to their customers as fast or faster, or at least less painfully, going into a bad, dirty shop with bad customer service.
Roy, you know, I was a history major in college, so I've always valued looking back and getting smarter by looking at the lessons we've accumulated over the years to help guide us forward. So this conversation has been, for me, fantastic. I think our listeners are going to really benefit from the experience you've shared, the perspective you've shared. And I want to thank you personally for joining us today and being on Convenience Matters. It was a fantastic time to talk to you.
Yep. My pleasure, and thanks for the invitation. It's my first podcast, and I really appreciate the opportunity to participate.
Add it to that long resume, and thank you for listening to Convenience Matters.
Convenience Matters is brought to you by NACS and produced in partnership with Human Factor. For more information, visit convenience.org.